I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. It's 9 a.m., and this is KBOO Portland, your community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromise news media. Today is January 16th, Martin Luther King Day, and he and his legacy will be in our thoughts throughout our program. Given all the upcoming demonstrations around Inauguration Day and the fact that it is Martin Luther King Day, Norm Diamond will do a well-read read revolving around John Berger's 1986 essay, The Nature of Mass Demonstrations. Berger is a brilliant art critic and essayist who died just 2 weeks ago. Also today, in acknowledgement of the likely devastating results of the Trump era, we are introducing a new weekly segment, the Old Mole Action Calendar. Community radio will play an important role in the period ahead, and the Old Mole will be one place for coalitional politics around activism. Jan Hawken will be continuing a conversation with Sophie Smith, an activist and humanitarian worker with No More Deaths, an organization in southern Arizona that works to stop the death and suffering in the borderlands, much of which is the direct result of U.S. Homeland Security policies. Leading off our program today, Bill Resnick will be talking to two Portlanders, Ted Dreyer and Harlan Schober, activists in the Standing Rock struggle over the pipeline. Ted and Harlan have outfitted a bus as a medical facility that they will be driving to Dakota next week. The interview will discuss the first great confrontation of the Trump era and the strategy being implemented for keep it in the ground actions around the nation. They also discuss the role of the city in resisting Trumpism. Bill?
Ted Dreyer, Harlan Schober, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to be here.
Both Ted and Harlan have been very active in the Standing Rock struggle to stop the Great Black Snake with its many counterpart pipelines snaking across lands all over the planet and threatening to make the planet uninhabitable. Ted and Harlan, tell us how you got involved in the Standing Rock struggle and why. And then we'll talk about the possibilities of severe repression, how the Trump administration will react to Standing Rock. It's likely to be the first big challenge to right-wing power over a crucial policy in the Trump administration. And just a hint to our audience, this has been anticipated by the movements, and we'll be discussing how the Great Civil Disobedience Movement is going to operate in the future. That is some of the plans. Who wants to go first?
Harlan, why don't you start, because you really helped start the bunk bus part of this project.
Sure. Okay. In September, a friend and I, Mike Horner and I, planned to make a trip to the Standing Rock area with donated supplies for the camp. And the response was just something I've never felt before. Goods kept showing up. We were planning to each take a pickup truck and a small trailer. Shortly, we had to rent a large Penske truck, and we filled it. We took five wood-burning stoves. We're estimating 30 tents, 40 or 50 sleeping bags, countless tarps, clothing, food, medical supplies. And we made the drive out, unloaded the truck, spent some time at the camp, and came back. And we realized that shelter was going to be the issue in the wintertime. It was a pleasant day in September. It was breezy and warm. But we knew that as soon as the breeze was no longer warm, it was going to be a real problem. And we spent a couple of weeks here in Portland when we got back just thinking about what would work. I can't remember how it came out really, but we ended up settling on the idea that converting a school bus to warm, dry shelter would work. And when we put the word out about that, my gosh, the support really flowed in. Volunteers, cash donors. We had donation of space where we could do the work. So we completed the bunk bus one and delivered that, commissioned that at the Ocheti Sakouin camp. And we were on the road back to Portland from that this last Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. That's how we got started.
And Ted, you were one of the early volunteers and got really active.
Well, actually, no, I was. I only got involved at the last minute, just before the first bunk bus went out. Yeah, I had participated in a demonstration after the Mosier derailment in the gorge, where we blocked in oil train tracks in Vancouver. And one of the people involved in that was helping with the bunk bus. And I contacted her, Bonnie McKinley, shortly before they left, saying, hey, do you know anybody who's going out to Standing Rock? And she put me in touch with the bunk bus. So because the underlying issue, the problem of an economy, exploitative economy that puts the value of profits made by fossil fuels over life and water and the health of the entire planet, was obviously a common theme. So after making that trip, which was so incredibly inspiring, I was completely hooked. And since then, I've done what I could to support the bunk bus.
Tell us a little bit more, Harlan, about your motives and what you think, and Ted, why it's so important to keep it in the ground, which is now part of an international movement.
Well, everyone tells us that the carbon will kill us, and if you leave it in the ground, it won't kill us, and that's the best sequestering we can do. So it's hard to even go back to having that discussion, but yes, keeping it in the ground is vitally important. The issue at Standing Rock is different than that and more than that. That involves Native sovereignty. It involves Indigenous people leading that segment of the movement. And it's a perfect coming together of interests.
And it involves water as well.
It involves water, but also Indigenous-led resistance to fossil fuel infrastructure has been winning. The Lummi defeated the coal terminal up in Bellingham area. It's having Indigenous groups take the lead. There's something very compelling about that. So in this matter of doing a bus, taking a bus out there, this is strictly an in-service function. We're providing a bus. The folks on site get to use it. They get to do what they need to do with it. So we're not in any leadership capacity at all. This is a service trip.
Although the bus is, it's sort of set up to be a medical facility. It will be the medical people who begin using it. Is that right?
Yeah, there are a lot of different interests in the camp. It's a coming together of a whole bunch of different nations who hadn't been talking to each other much for a while. So they have their own differences. They have their own politics to work out. Nothing I know anything about. The reason we've attached ourselves to the medical and healing council folk is that they, by all appearances, are serving everyone equally. So we're not involved with any of that. We're just providing a bus for the guys who take care of the water protectors.
The wonderful thing about this practical, functional vehicle and this project, which, as Harlan just said, is in response to a call from Standing Rock for support, is that even though it's very practical, hands-on, a matter of bolting plywood onto an old bus, installing insulation, it has functioned as a focus to move people who otherwise haven't been involved to be able in a very practical way to support the bus. And the conversations that have gone on around this very practical effort and the amount of energy it has generated have been really amazing, so that basically, I think what has been amazing about the Native American opposition to this particular pipeline is the way that especially the people at Standing Rock have been able to articulate it as a symbol of a movement against not only one specific pipeline, and that's sort of the importance of the symbol of the pipeline as a black snake, meaning it's something larger. There's an entire way of living, economic system, a cultural system that is exploiting the earth in a way that is incredibly damaging to human life. And the symbol that water is life captures that in a brilliant way that has been able to attract a huge amount of attention. And what the bunk bus has done is to just offer an instrument for a lot of people here in our area to get involved in that. And I really think that this project is in many ways a kind of a model, because Harlan and Mike started out with nothing more than inspiration by Standing Rock, just with an idea. They didn't have a lot of money. And the energy flowed in, and the volunteer hours, literally thousands of volunteer hours flowed in. The time between the day they bought the bus and we left for Standing Rock was exactly 3 weeks. How can you transpose an old school bus into an outstanding medical facility in 3 weeks? I mean, it wouldn't seem possible. It's kind of a miracle, really. And that is a testimony to the power of the energies coming out of Standing Rock, and the power of the human imagination to rise up and oppose this incredibly oppressive system, which constantly generates the message that there is no alternative, as Maggie Thatcher loved always to say. Resistance is futile. Look at the weapons we have. Look at the armed, militarized police we have. Forget standing up. And this, as we move into the Trump era, will be all that much more important.
Yeah, you're talking about the inspiration, the knowledge, the brother and sisterhood that gets developed. It's the spread of that spirit and the knowledge and the commitment that is ultimately, it seems to me, through the people in all sorts of actions and practice that's going to turn the tide. This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Ted Dreyer and Harlan Schober, who have been instrumental. Harlan was one of the co-founders of the Bus Bunk Project. They're taking another bus out to for the medical people at Standing Rock. They're going to be doing that, I believe, next week. Next week is also going to be the first days of the Trump presidency. Yeah. This is going to be his first crisis, it looks like. I mean, he has already said he's going to end it quickly. I think he's a man of his word. On his whatever words that he says, as erratic and contradictory and, as you point out, barbaric as he is, I believe he's a man of that word resonates with his character. He's going to try and end it quickly. As an example, my theory of Reagan's PATCO, when he destroyed the air traffic controller union as a demonstration to all corporations actually to crack down on your workers and we'll support you. That was a successful maneuver by the Reaganites. I think it's pretty clear they're going to be used repressive items, the police in North Dakota, and also now the militarization and the army possibilities and their crackdown and the charging of absurd lengthy felony sentences for civil disobedience. They will cook things up. It's all very frightening. The protectors of Standing Rock and the tribes and everybody else knows that's likely to happen. And it's been happening all over the country. The response to that kind of oppression and pressure and police state sort of tactics is to disperse things all over, make it impossible for them to deal with an entire country that is, in fact, challenging not just the fossil fuel industry, but the way the current economic system works to destroy the planet.
What you're saying, Bill, is right on, and I think they will focus on Standing Rock, and I think that is because they understand the power of this movement, and they understand how incredibly effective it has been and what a threat it poses to them, so which is a kind of a stunning backhand recognition of the, again, the power of a small disenfranchised group of people, the native people gathered at Standing Rock, to make a difference. So that is stunning. But I also want to point out at this point, the worst things that have happened there, the dogs that were set on the water protectors and the incredible evening that Harlan mentioned before at the bridge where the water protectors were sprayed with water, shot with rubber bullets, and so on, they have attracted more media attention and more sympathy for this movement than anything that has happened. And it really reminds me of the dogs set on the demonstrators at Birmingham, and many people have drawn that connection, which helped to propel the civil rights movement back then to its highest successes. So I am not, of course, looking forward to any kind of violent oppression of the Standing Rock. movement. But I can say that the Native people at Standing Rock insisted that they were not that interested in the election because no matter what happens, they have already survived the worst oppressive actions that this nation has brought against any people anywhere. And just like some were saying, they wouldn't be able to stand up to the North Dakota winter. Well, they've been doing that for millennia, and they will stand up.
Harlan, you mentioned the Lummi near Billingham. Yes. It's happening all over the country, is my sense. There are pipelines being challenged.
I think there are encampments in Texas, in Florida, in Iowa, and elsewhere. I forget the name of the big encampment in Arizona, and I never could pronounce the name of the encampment up in Canada, in Alberta, I think it is. But the practice of putting bodies in the way of pipelines and other fossil fuel infrastructure projects has been going on for a while, and we'll try to support as much of that as we can.
We can add to that Minnesota, Florida, Hawaii, Washington, Wyoming. The inspiration emanating from Standing Rock is not something that can easily be stopped at this point.
No, and in the cities, there are coal trains that are being stopped.
The people in cities
have a huge role, in fact, in not just keeping it in the ground, but in fact building a very different economy, really reconstructing cities. I'd like to talk about that just for a second, state of hypothesis.
Before we move into that, I'd just like to bring into this business of the various encampments. We also had the valve turner folk, the five teams that turned off the flow of oil from Canada into the U.S. This dispersed all kinds of people doing all kinds of actions. It's this decentralized kind of movement that you talked about earlier that I think is our hope.
In the past decade, it has been sometimes really hard to organize opposition because the issues are also complex. If you sit down and try to explain to someone the economics of capitalism and the way that we are being oppressed and the connection between what the banks did in 2008, it's very complicated. It's difficult to understand, and it's hard to organize around complex analyses of economic systems. But the Standing Rock movement, with its simple formula, water is life, has galvanized people in a way that nothing else, because that is a straightforward, it is a simple formula, but it is not superficial. It is incredibly profound, and it expresses, and the Standing Rock movement has expressed, this combination of a movement that is spiritual without being flaky. It's profoundly economic, political, and listening when we were there to the elders speak in the so-called in the prayer ceremonies in the morning, it's very clear that they understand this movement as an attempt to oppose the entire economic exploitative system. And that, I think, has really inspired people. The bunk bus is just part of that, and all of these other camps that have risen up and the multiple protest movements that are coming about are, I think, responses and reflections to the power of that symbolism. I think we in the left have often been too abstract in our attempt to motivate and communicate with people. And this has really provided us with a symbol that is very potent.
I think people do catch on, actually, once they get involved.
Mm-hmm.
People do understand, almost everybody understands that on a finite planet, you cannot have infinite growth, that the thing has to stop, and that capitalism means growth.
Yeah.
I think they understand that how the system works to grow and grow and grow and ultimately destroy the planet. I think they're catching on. Part of it is just getting into practice and realizing that you can stop this machine and that there are alternatives, and people see alternatives in their neighborhood. They understand that solar power and wind power are now cheaper than the fossil fuels or nuclear. Yeah. I think people are wising up to it in lots of ways because, though, there is this resistance and great struggle and sympathy for it.
Well, I just want to say that it's really interesting that Nestle chairman Peter Brabeck just asserted that people do not have a right to water because, of course, Nestle would like to corner the water market and transform water into just one more commodity that you can use to squeeze money out of people, just at the time when the people at Standing Rock are emphasizing that water is life, meaning that human beings, it's not so much we have a right to this particular chemical called water, but we have a right to live, and that we have to stand up for that value, that very fundamental value with all its physical, economic, and spiritual implications. And I'm very grateful to that movement that they have given us a rallying point.
I want to thank you, Harlan Schober and Ted Dreyer, for your work. Drive safely out to North Dakota.
All right, we'll try.
And it's both heroic and inspiring, and more than that. And give our regards in Portland to the people resisting and pushing forward in Standing Rock and other places.
Thanks
to
you, Bill.
Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks to the Old Mole and to Kebu.
Let's Impeach the President. That was Neil Young, of course. The song was written about Bush, but you know the old saying, if the shoe fits. This is KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Coming up now, Norm Diamond will read from and share his thoughts on the John Berger essay, The Nature of Mass Demonstrations.
I shall indeed. Thank you, Tom. In the years when I regularly hosted the Old Mole, I used to begin the program sometimes by saying something like, on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we not only celebrate the myriad ways people push for alternatives, we analyze them. Not all forms of resistance can be effective, can change what exists. That was part of our mission then, and it continues. It is now as well. We not only report, but we evaluate. We try to figure out what works. And what we mean by works or success. That led me to today's reading, basically, an essay by John Berger, he wrote in 1968, called The Nature of Mass Demonstrations. There are three different prompts that produced today's reading. One is Berger's own death a couple of weeks ago. One of my favorite essayists, somebody I turned to for insights on a vast variety of topics, died at, what was he, 90, 92 years old, just 2 weeks ago. But the second prompt leading to this reading, The Nature of Mass Demonstrations, is, of course, today is MLK Day. Martin Luther King made very effective use of mass demonstrations. And the third prompt is that this coming weekend, we, people here in the Old Mole at KBOO, and a lot of you out there will actually be involved in mass demonstrations. So here are some excerpts from John Berger's essay, The Nature of Mass Demonstrations. I emphasize these are excerpts. The entire essay, well, I'll tell you at the end how to get a hold of it. But here are some of the provocative things that he has to say. Theoretically, demonstrations are meant to reveal the strength of popular opinion or feeling. Theoretically, they are an appeal to the democratic conscience of the state. But this presupposes a conscience which is very unlikely to exist. If the state authority is open to democratic influence, the demonstration will hardly be necessary. If it is not, it is unlikely to be influenced by an empty show of force containing no real threat. The truth is that mass demonstrations are rehearsals for revolution. Not strategic or even tactical ones, but rehearsals of revolutionary awareness. Any demonstration which lacks this element of rehearsal is better described as an officially encouraged public spectacle. State authorities usually lie about the number of demonstrators involved. The lie, however, makes little difference. the importance of the numbers involved is to be found in the direct experience of those taking part in, or sympathetically witnessing, the demonstration. Those who take part become more positively aware of how they belong to a class. Belonging to that class ceases to imply a common fate and implies a common opportunity. Revolutionary awareness is rehearsed in another way by the choice and effect of location. Demonstrations are essentially urban in character, and they are usually planned to take place as near as possible to some symbolic center, either civic or national. Their targets are seldom the strategic ones: railway stations, barracks, radio stations. And here I intervene. John Berger would have been a strong supporter of KABU. Or airports. A mass demonstration can be interpreted as the symbolic capturing of a city or capital. Again, the symbolism is for the benefit of the participants. The demonstrators interrupt the regular life of the streets they march through or of the open spaces they fill. They cut off these areas, and not yet having the power to occupy them permanently, they transform them into a temporary stage on which they dramatize the power they still lack. The demonstrators' view of the city surrounding their stage also changes. By demonstrating, they manifest a greater freedom and independence, greater creativity, even although the product is only symbolic, than they can ever achieve individually or collectively when pursuing their regular lives. In their regular pursuits, they only modify circumstances. By demonstrating, they symbolically oppose their very existence to circumstances. Finally, there is another way in which revolutionary awareness is rehearsed. The demonstrators present themselves as a target to the so-called forces of law and order. The contradiction between their actual vulnerability and their sense of invincibility corresponds to the dilemma which they force upon the state authority. Either authority must abdicate and allow the crowd to do as it wishes, or else authority must constrain and disperse the crowd with violence. The imposed dilemma is between displayed weakness and displayed authoritarianism. The officially approved and controlled demonstration does not impose the same dilemma. Now, here Berger is talking about a kind of issue that faces us frequently in Portland, whether to get permits or not. So this is his characterization of permitted marches. The officially approved and controlled demonstration does not impose the same dilemma. Its symbolism is censored, which is why I term it a mere public spectacle. Berger, in other words, is taking the position to not get permits, something by and large I support. There are very few circumstances in which I would want to get permits for a march that we are entitled to participate in. Back to Berger. It is in the nature of a demonstration to provoke violence upon itself. Its provocation may also be violent, but in the end it is bound to suffer more than it inflicts. This is a tactical truth and an historical one. The historical role of demonstrations is to show the injustice, cruelty, irrationality of the existing state authority. Demonstrations are protests of innocence. But the innocence is of two kinds. There is an innocence to be defended, and an innocence which must finally be lost, an innocence which derives from justice, and an innocence which is the consequence of a lack of experience. Demonstrations express political ambitions before the political means necessary to realize them have been created. Demonstrations predict the realization of their own ambitions and thus may contribute to that realization, but they cannot themselves achieve them. The question which revolutionaries must decide in any given historical situation is whether or not further symbolic rehearsals are necessary. The next stage is training in tactics and strategy for the performance itself. I've been reading some excerpts, and I would encourage you to find the complete essay, John Berger's 1968 essay, The Nature of Mass Demonstrations. Berger was writing, of course, in May 1968, right at the same time as the events in France, the huge uprising, and 1 month after the assassination of Martin Luther King and the demonstrations which followed there. Today is MLK Day. This is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Norm. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We at the Old Mole believe that sustained political involvement and activism is a necessity to avoid or at least mitigate the catastrophe that's about to descend on the nation in the form of a Trump presidency. So today we are introducing a new weekly feature on our program called the Old Mole Action Calendar. Community radio will play an important role in the period ahead, and the Old Mole will be one place for coalitional politics around activism. Listeners are invited to send us events of or people who might be interviewed for the calendar. It could involve a short interview, field report, or a list of rallies and protest events for the upcoming week. You can reach us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Today, obviously, our focus is on the upcoming events and protests involving Inauguration Day. I suggest, if you are interested, to grab paper and pencil, as I will be discussing a number of events. Today is Martin Luther King Day, and it is a uniquely appropriate day to launch this new feature. To get inspired for the struggle to come, there is an event taking place today called A Single Garment of Destiny, a tribute to the life and legacy of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Its theme is Keep Alive the Dream. The event is being held at the Highland Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason Street, here in Portland. It will be starting in just over an hour at 11 a.m. and runs all day until 6 p.m. Sponsored by the World Arts Foundation and too many local groups to mention, this is the 32nd consecutive tribute to King, indisputably one of the great American heroes and world citizens. Portland's annual Keep Alive the Dream is recognized regionally and nationally as one of the largest community-based celebrations in the U.S. The event offers to give voice to the heritage of ordinary citizens' struggle for peace, social justice, civil rights, and human dignity. Again, the event takes place at Highland Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason Street here in Portland. It will be starting in just over an hour at 11 a.m. There are many events scheduled here in Portland leading up to Inauguration Day and Inauguration Day weekend. Thousands of people are planning to attend. This Thursday, January 19th, there's an anti-Betsy DeVos protest. Portland students are planning to walk out of class on Thursday afternoon and rally at Pioneer Courthouse Square in protest over Trump's pick for Secretary of Education. DeVos is an anti-public education radical and supporter of charter schools. That's Thursday afternoon at Pioneer Courthouse Square. On Friday the 20th, Inauguration Day, more than 9,000 people are expected to march. Organizers say the peaceful march will introduce the Portland organizations who will be on the front lines in the collective struggle against the Trump regime. The protests will start at 3:30 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square and last until about 9 p.m. The main Portland events will take place the next day, Saturday, January 21st. The FFL-CIO and affiliates and other unions have put out a call to labor and the community for a rally and march to present a united front against the Trump agenda. The march and rally will be Saturday the 21st from 10 to 11:30 a.m. at Szymanski Park, located in the park blocks at Southwest Park and Salmon, and will march to the waterfront. The announcement for the event states that the election of Donald Trump is dangerous for all working people, our unions, and especially immigrants, people of color, women, and LGBTQ people. Fear and anger in the face of the Trump agenda is widespread in union ranks. Now is the time to call for a labor-led mass mobilization to give our members and other workers the confidence and determination to unite and fight back. Again, this action begins at Chemansky Park, located at the park blocks at Southwest Park and Salmon, and will march to the waterfront. It begins at 10 a.m. and ends at 11:30 a.m. at the waterfront. If you join the march to the waterfront, you can then join the Women's March in Portland, which immediately follows at noon at the Tom McCall Waterfront Park. This promises to be the biggest march ever in Portland. More than 26,000 people have said they will attend. The organizers have said the march represents Portland's diverse community. Their statement reads, "The Women's March in Portland is aligned with the mission of the Women's March on Washington, D.C., whose mission statement says it is to unify and empower everyone who stands for women's rights, human rights, immigrant rights, civil liberties, and social justice for all." The Portland event will take place simultaneously with similar marches around the state and country. Again, the Portland Women's March is scheduled to begin at Saturday noon, January 21st, and last until 4 p.m. The meeting place is Tom McCall Waterfront Park. There's also a pre-march children's event scheduled for 11 a.m. Well, I'm sure there are other events also taking place over the weekend, and these are just a few of them. The lesson we need to take away from these protests is that this is only the beginning. If we are to have any hope of truly having an impact on the Trump agenda, we must dedicate ourselves to be out protesting until this nightmare is over. See you in the streets. Doobie Brothers, Taking It to the Streets. This is KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now Jan Hawken continues an ongoing conversation with Sophie Smith, an activist with No More Deaths, which offers support and aid for immigrants at the Arizona-Mexican border. Sophie is on the abuse documentation team for No More Deaths and participated in a recent report called The Disappeared, which includes the Border Patrol tactic of pushing migrants into the back country, where the risk of death is much higher. Jan?
Welcome to KBOO, Sophie Smith.
Hi, Jan. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you've been a regular on the Old Mole over the past few years, bringing us your seasonal reports on the borderlands in Arizona. And as a humanitarian worker with No More Deaths, you've been involved in a recent report on deaths caused by border tactics. And that report explains that, quote, people who cross the border and are never seen again do not merely go missing. They're disappeared by the U.S. border enforcement system. It's a quote from that report. I'd like you to talk about that system and the report, as well as what activists and humanitarian workers are doing in response to the Trump administration coming into power. But first, could you say a little about No More Deaths and their work that led to this report?
Sure. So the report was put out, it was a partnership effort between No More Deaths, which I've been working with since 2010. It's a direct aid organization that we walk the back country along the U.S.-Mexico border and provide food and water and medical care to people who are attempting to migrate into the U.S. who find themselves lost or injured or left behind and at risk of dying. And so No More Deaths' mission is to end death and suffering in the desert through this kind of direct aid approach. And then Derechos Humanos is a community organization in Tucson that was the partner in the report who run a missing migrant hotline where a family who have had members who have attempted to cross and never turned up in the U.S. or in the detention system would call into Derechos Humanos and they would provide assistance in trying to locate them. So the report was really a partnership between these two organizations doing different kinds of crisis response and relief work out here on the border.
So that coalitional effort will perhaps be important as you continue work and as the anti-immigration politics along the border are likely to intensify.
Yeah, I think so. And I think part of releasing this report, so this report calls attention to what we're calling the crisis of disappearance in the borderlands. And both organizations have firsthand experience with hundreds of cases of people who have become lost or left behind and who have perished in the backcountry. And I think it's an important moment to release the report because it sort of sets the stage for what we're dealing with moving forward. We can see that we've already, for about 20 years, had a border policy that's extremely deadly, extremely disastrous for people crossing. And so when we talk about more walls, more security infrastructure under the Trump administration, I think it's really important to start from where we are and to mark what's already been going on, kind of a bipartisan policing effort.
You've spoken before, and this report emphasizes the visibility of loss, suffering, death, and trauma in the borderlands, and how the tactics literally push migrants out of the political field of vision, putting them at risk. And they have their own charts and graphs that have numbers clearly underestimates, but they track these data over time and make claims around them. How do you think about the politics of representing the deaths and suffering in the borderlands that are so out of view? And there's often sometimes a risk, too, of over-sensationalizing extreme suffering to make the problem visible.
Sure. Yeah, I think that that's completely true, that not only metaphorically is the crisis invisible, but literally is, in the sense that since the 1990s, Border Patrol has been building walls and concentrating infrastructure around ports of entry and cities along the border where civilization can be found in order to deflect migrant traffic out into the backcountry where there's really no one around. I live in a small rural town that's in the middle of this migration corridor that flows through the desert, very far away from any access to infrastructure, to rescue if someone is lost or left behind. And that means that this kind of massive scenario of human suffering is taking place mostly out of sight of the general public, and it also means that when people lose their lives from preventable maladies, just like dehydration or lower extremity injuries and things like that that strand them in the wilderness, it means that they don't have access to help and that when they perish in the backcountry, often they're never found. So we have a lot of trouble producing statistics on how many people actually die while attempting to cross the border, and this report really attempts to name that by calling it a crisis of disappearance, that there's a way in which, you know, Border Patrol reports that since the 90s about 6,000 people have died on the southwest border. Those are only the numbers that have been found, so we know that the crisis is much larger. So I think it's important to try to produce numbers but also recognize a system of violence that actually defies the ability to account. And I think that that's something that we struggle with as activists, as a way of kind of making sense of the political scenario to the public.
You also describe in the report something called the chase and scatter tactic of Border Patrol. Can you say a little more about that?
Yeah, so this is the first part of the report. It's called Deadly Apprehension Methods in the Wilderness of Chase and Scatter. So what that's looking at is once people are pushed out into these long desert crossings through the wilderness, we find that Border Patrol's activities, the actual border policing activities, are extremely dangerous, where if Border Patrol identifies people who are crossing and attempts to apprehend them, what we found is that very often this leads to chases through very dangerous and rugged terrain, chases that 41% of the chases through terrain in the backcountry we found led to injury from the terrain. So sprains, breaks, falls, even drownings when we're talking about Texas and the Rio Grande River. And then also that agents are assaulting people violently in the backcountry and using dogs. We had a lot of cases of tasers and dog bites, beatings. We found that 18% of the people chased by Border Patrol in the backcountry were assaulted by those agents, and that they're prone to excessive force in these areas if no one is around. So what we came to believe as researchers was that there isn't a safe way to apprehend people in the desert, out in the backcountry, in terrain where if someone runs away, they're likely to either become injured or become lost and disoriented. So when we're talking about scatter, that's the other piece, that we found that Border Patrol is prone to use tactics like helicopters that cause groups of people migrating together to run in every direction, leading migrants to lose their companions, their guides, often any water or food they might have had with them, and to become lost in a landscape that doesn't offer many resources or access to rescue. So we're really looking at the way that everyday Border Patrol practices in the backcountry really exacerbate this missing persons crisis that we're dealing with on the ground.
There'll be many demonstrations, including here in Portland, this coming weekend, and hopefully continuing in the upcoming period, sustained resistance to the right-wing policies as well as ongoing policies of our government that are oppressive to migrants and other vulnerable groups. And part of the discourse on this casts urban and especially urban communities on the coast as more progressive and rural areas as backward, but you have quite a coalition of groups there in Arizona, in a very conservative state, that are resisting these immoral practices of Border Patrol agents authorized by our government. Can you say a little about that as a broader, perhaps, story about rural resistance as well to these oppressive practices?
Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting moment. Out here on the border, I've been working out here for about 6 years, and I've always felt that there's been a real ethic of direct assistance in the work that's going on out here, in addition to any kind of public agitation that we're going to provide what people need on the ground and not wait for policies to change. And I think that that's become even more ingrained since the election among various groups. And it's become clear that, you know, I don't think that we can expect a lot of traction from the powers that be and a lot of responsiveness. And I see the groups that are working out here really buckling in and trying to strengthen our ties and coordinate. So at this point, we have multiple community groups, for example, that are doing search and rescue on low budgets throughout the border. Groups like Aguilas del Desierto coming out of California and the South Texas Human Rights Center, and then the Ajo Samaritans and No More Deaths. So there really is a growing, strong, coordinated effort to try to provide direct relief on the ground in these areas that are, you know, if they're populated, they're populated by rural small towns. And I think the other kind of piece of that is a community organizing effort that I've been a part of to get rural communities that are living in the midst of this disaster, getting people together and saying, look, we can do what we can as residents. We can provide water. We can support medical care for folks who are crossing. So I think it's a really important time for us to hold tight to each other and really feel that we can provide for people without having to wait, because I don't think that the power structure is going to deliver right now around migrant justice, unfortunately. So I think, you know, there's really a strong sense that we need to do it ourselves.
You're saying there are these rural ethics, and one can romanticize those rural ethics, I suppose, just as one can produce a stereotype that's a degrading and oversimplified stereotype of rural life. But you're very drawn to rural life and the beauty of the desert. And even with this suffering, you've written quite eloquently about the life that continues to be lived on so many levels, and the beauty of the desert, and some of what is grounding and sustaining about communities living in the borderlands.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little about that, and perhaps close by talking some about coalitions that do involve perhaps some of the larger cities in Arizona or elsewhere, and alliances with rural communities?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have been very drawn to rural life on the border and to the land. When you get out here in southern Arizona, it's high desert territory. It's extremely stunning, and the folks who live out here have a deep appreciation for the land. And I think that's part of what's so heartbreaking about what's happening in the desert, and the way, you know, the report really tries to get at the way that U.S. border enforcement agencies have strategically used the land base, the desert itself, as a weapon, as a policing weapon. And
pushing people into very high-risk situations.
Yeah, and that's very heartbreaking for desert dwellers and people who really feel at home on the land. And so, yeah, and I think that it is true that out here there's a lot of interdependency and a culture of mutual aid that kind of comes naturally to people living out. And they, you know, folks need to be able to rely on each other, and that makes a lot of sense to people before or beyond politics. I found that really inspiring, to the sense that whether or not someone believes that immigration should be more legal or less legal. It's difficult to find anyone living down here who thinks that someone should lose their life in the desert for crossing into the U.S. without papers, and I find that really heartening. And I think there is somewhat of a disconnect out here in Arizona between rural groups and those in the cities, which is a little different in a place like Texas where you have a city like McAllen that's really large, that's within the militarized zone of the border. Out here, most of the inhabitants in the militarized zone are small town residents. So there's definitely a strong coalition among us down here. I think, you know, I can't really speak to the city context right now, probably.
Well, there's more work to be done, and hopefully we can contribute here on the Old Mole Variety Hour and bridging some of that gap. And we look forward to having you on the show again, giving us further reports. This is Jan Hawken talking with Sophie Smith with No More Deaths about their reports on the crisis in the borderlands, the crisis of the disappeared. Just in closing, can you direct us to the website where people can read the report, Sophie?
Yeah, the report is online at www.thedisappearedreport.org, and there's a beautiful video, too, that that displays our findings.
It is, yes. It's an impressive piece of work. Thanks so much, Sophie Smith, for being with
thank
us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well, can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the Mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at the existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. I'd like to end our program today with a quote from Martin Luther King that isn't often cited in mainstream media. Again, Dr. Kim begins, "Again, we have deluded ourselves into believing the myth that capitalism grew and prospers out of the Protestant ethic of hard work and sacrifice. The fact is that capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves and continues to thrive in the exploitation of the poor, both black and white, both here and abroad." That was from a speech called Three Evils of Society from 1967.